from the campus of the University of Pennsylvania Wharton School.
This is Wharton Moneyball on Business Radio.
Welcome. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. 2 hours of sports analytics live. Not so live. We're recording it live. Not going to edit this thing, but it'll be posted on Wednesday. This is Monday afternoon. Cade Massey with the whole team here. Audie Weiner, Shane Jensen, Eric Bradlow. As we do every week, we come talk about sports analytics for a couple of hours. For the last year, we've been doing it virtually via Zoom. We will do our normal schedule, which is about half an hour on COVID-19 related stuff in the first quarter. We'll do a couple of quarters on various sports topics, and we'll wrap up with an interview. This week, we're talking to Ken Pomeroy. Ken is the founder of early founder on basketball analytics, and especially we hit March. We're recording this on March 1. The big sporting event in March is the March Madness College Basketball Tournament. It was canceled last year. They're going to hold it this year. And so we're beginning to turn our eyes to basketball. Ken Pomeroy is going to educate us on the college basketball season and what to expect in March. Guys, before we get to sports, COVID is the context of our lives and the context of our sports lives. It is a dynamic world out there. Lots of moving parts. Curious what has caught your eye in the world of coronavirus.
Well, it has to be the J&J approval. I think that has to be on everybody's radar as the number one thing that has caught everybody's attention. So what this means for the United States, what it means for the rest of the world is remains to be seen. But I think it's fantastic news.
I think the interesting part of it is it shows you even, you know, when you hear, and I'm going to build on what Adi said, which I agree with. When you hear the word experiment and you hear the word effectiveness, you think these things can be easily compared, but they cannot. And that's one of the things I wanted to talk about, which is, you know, first of all, we talked about this a couple of weeks ago briefly, but maybe if J&J gave two shots 3 weeks apart, it would be just as effective as Moderna and Pfizer. Or maybe if they had been run at the same time, the J&J one got ran 3 months later, where the South African and the other variants, and the proportion of South Africans is even larger in their trial data. And here's the number I care about as a potential recipient of the Johnson & Johnson. 100% of the individuals who got the Johnson & Johnson, they had no hospitalizations and no deaths. And so that's the number. I don't know why, I'll put on my marketing hat. Why do they keep saying 72% effective? Like, I understand I could get a severe flu, but I could get the severe flu from the flu. 0% deaths, 0% hospitalizations of people injected once from the Johnson & Johnson. 0%. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. I think the answer has to do with power, right? I mean, the idea is that there just aren't that many cases of severe disease in the control group. And so it becomes very hard to make categorical statements of 100%, because when you're dealing with handfuls of cases, you're looking at basically very crude estimates.
I'm with you.
For one thing that is actually quite interesting about the J&J vaccine is that in the control group, this time there were actual deaths, not even just a few. 7 of them, I believe, was the total. They were in South Africa, but in the treatment group, there were none. As opposed to the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccine, there were no deaths in the control group, meaning that nobody who didn't get the vaccine, who got the placebo, actually died of the virus. There were 168 cases, but there were not, and I think that may have been Pfizer or Moderna. I always flip the two. They were very similar. Nobody actually died. And I think there's only one ICU admittance in the control group for that one. So this is not as effective in terms of infection, but at least they had a control group that had some really bad outcomes.
Did they have the same age distribution in those? Is the age distribution kind of the same across these different?
Don't know the answer. And that
I know the country distribution is not the same. That much I do know. But I wanted to ask you guys a question. So related to that. So you could make – what about the following data point? The J&J one, its effectiveness gets there within certainly 28 days. But even after 14 days, it gets close to its maximal effectiveness. The two-shot Pfizer and Moderna regime takes – you get a shot. You then 3 or 4 weeks have to take another shot. And then 2 weeks after that, it's 6 weeks. And so – couldn't you make an argument from a purely saving lives efficacy point of view? I mean, besides the Johnson & Johnson is a single shot, which makes it from a distribution point of view advantageous, you only have to wait 2.5-3 weeks and you get its full effect, where for the Pfizer and Moderna, as far as we know, it's 2 weeks after the second shot.
Eric, one refinement there. I believe we do know now that the one shot of Pfizer, 4 weeks after your first shot of Pfizer, you are, what was the Israeli study, like 86% effective.
That's starting to sound a lot like the Johnson & Johnson after about 28 days is all I'm saying, because theirs was 85% against preventing severe illness.
So, I mean, guys, I kind of feel like people who are arguing about details on this are just classic academics, you know, worrying about decimal places where they're missing the big picture. The big picture here is that there's a third vaccine that's wildly effective, and it might even have some, it does have some logistical advantages. One shot doesn't require the freezing. So I, it's interesting to dive into the details, but big picture, let's not bury the lead. Big picture, this thing is effective, and it's going to be an extraordinary addition to the arsenal.
And I think, you know, that is, again, also advantageous as far as distribution, but it's also advantageous in terms of kind of robustness to new variants, right? I mean, the fact that we have multiple vaccines that aren't all the, you know, necessarily, you know, working on the exact same part of the virus and everything like that is something that's got to make it more robust to new variants.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm just going to throw this out here, is that what's so important about this is that you got to get the vaccines in the arms to as much of the population as you can, as quickly as you can. And this idea that we're starting from the top in terms of risk and sort of moving down leaves huge swaths of the population where nobody is vaccinated and they all see each other. So like 20s and 30s. So, and what this vaccine is going to do is allow you to get penetration down into the youngest age groups, which are the biggest spreaders, as fast as possible, which will allow the exponential decay to really kick in. Right now, it's not exponentially. We're getting improvements fractionally, which is hugely different than exponentially.
Yeah. So let me ask you guys a question. Do you think the following will happen? Number one, here's a sequence of questions, which I don't know that we know the answer to, but as statisticians, we can think about. Do we think that it'll end up that Pfizer and Moderna will be given to the higher risk people, and then Johnson and Johnson will be given to the younger ones?
Wow, good question. I think so, because I think children.
Because the other older people, over 50% of the sick people, 65 and above, have already gotten it. So by de facto. But you could argue that's a good stride. How about the following? Let me go back to Shane's point. I don't know if this is true, but here's a hypothesis. Could it be that taking one shot of J&J and one shot of one of the other ones would, I don't want to call it confusing, but I'd call it like an obstacle course, could make it a greater obstacle course for the virus to get through, which would mean maybe that's what will be the recommended protocol later on.
I don't know any more about viruses than you do, but I mean, I do know like treatments for HIV, which is one of these viruses.
Cocktail approach.
The sort of ensemble method is definitely used for HIV.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Shane used my magic word. We've learned a few things in statistics in the last 20 years, and one of them is ensembles work.
That's right. Well, so let's talk about what else we're seeing out there right now. One piece of news that just came through a colleague and a friend out at UCSD, that San Diego County just said, okay, all people in a number of industries, including education and food service, and some pretty broad categories, all people, come get your vaccines. And that included the university in San Diego, so UCSD. And so all of a sudden, all the faculty there are eligible. In fact, our buddy got a shot this past weekend. And then Eric's telling me that's already the case. NYU is the same. So Eric, what's the story in New York City?
Well, so I went on to New York's website, because when a friend of mine at the NYU marketing department, I think he might have just turned 40. He might be under 40, perfectly healthy. I went onto their website. Higher education workers are in Group 1B. They are entirely eligible. And I didn't do it, but I mean, I might know. I'm from New York. I have my parents' address, but I didn't do it. I pretended as if I still lived in that area code, and it said, yep, here's the links. Go sign up and get your vaccination. So I didn't do it, but I'm just commenting. Absolutely, in New York, professors are eligible, and they can go to the website and sign up.
And I'll just respond. I have a sister who is a professor in New York City at the City College. This has been almost from the very beginning, eligibility for professors. But they had a caveat. You had to be an in-classroom teacher. So any education at any level, from preschool to graduate school and anything in between, although SoulCycle apparently no. I don't know if you heard about that scandal. but was eligible, but you had to be a classroom teacher. So if you were in the, if you were virtually teaching, you were considered ineligible. But just to throw this in, all of this was on a attestation basis. No proof was required.
Correct.
So you could have, so Eric, I mean, you could have been a guest lecturer in my class. You would have been a classroom teacher. You live in New York City. I could have gotten you in 2 months ago, or maybe not quite that long ago, but maybe 4 or 6 weeks ago. That's the way it is.
Yeah. So no, I'm just saying it just shows you not only how much differences there are, but I think you guys know this. Philadelphia is struggling to get through 1A, and they've already announced that higher education will be 1C, so not even 1B. And then in my case, as I think I told you guys last week, I'm even more screwed because even though I am a professor at Penn, I don't live in Philadelphia. And so because of the shortage in Pennsylvania,
you have to be
1C and living in Philly for Penn to vaccinate. Like right now, I've been told I will not get my vaccination through Penn unless something changes. Now, maybe something will change. But at the moment, I'm not even in Penn's 1C.
Guys, I was shocked. I just heard this morning from a colleague that I teach with, a senior colleague of all of ours, who lives in Montgomery County, which is mainline
where I live.
Philadelphia. Yep. It's like, he's 1A, and he just got his shot. I mean, we've been vaccinating people for 2 months now?
Kate, here's the number. The number is right now, and I know this, where I live, Adi lives as well, 180,000 people signed up in 1A, and they have vaccinated 30,000 of that 180,000 in 1A. That's 1A. Matter of fact, I know the date because it's on their website. As long as you signed up for 1A prior to, and get this date, January 13th is the date they're vaccinating now. January 13th. If you signed up between January 13th and today, March 1st, you're still on the wait list even to get an appointment as a 1A person.
The disparities are, this is literally first world problem because we're talking about disparities within the United States. The disparities across the globe are going to be even bigger, but the disparities are striking. Connecticut, remember Connecticut last week, we were talking about Connecticut going to a strictly age-based system. We're going to throw out all these fine criteria. They're too confusing. They clog up the logistics. We're going to a straight age. And by the way, if you look at CDC data, you download it. We've been talking about this every week as well. Connecticut at this point is about the fourth highest in the country, I believe, and they have vaccinated 20% of their population. 20% of their population have at least one shot in their arm.
Can I just throw in with that? Yes, they are number four, but the ones ahead of them are very, very sparsely
tiny.
Populated.
Yeah, right.
Dakota, Alaska. So for a major population center, they've done a great job. And I have to say, I think that was exactly the way to go. One of the reasons why you have such a hard time here is that we have this appointments kind of, you have to be very computer literate. You have to be able to load the web page 100 times and look for vacancies. And this has favored the people who have those skills and they've been privileged by this. And without them, you suffer. What a lot of places are doing, I've noticed, is sort of pairing up seniors who've had a hard time getting an appointment with essentially college kids. Who then do this for them and find and secure them the appointments. And I've been part of some nonprofits and some synagogues, and I'm sure churches are doing this too, to try to link up their young kids who are to help find spots for their seniors.
Millennials helping the boomers out.
Yeah.
Good. So guys, I've felt it and I've heard a few others say it. I'm curious to what extent you agree with it, that within 6 weeks or so, plus or minus maybe a couple, we're going to be awash in vaccine, with Moderna and Pfizer both saying that they're cranking up manufacturing and they're not that far away from really kicking out some volume, with J&J coming online. Is it how confident are you that, sometime in April-ish, we'll have plenty of vaccine to go around, and then the challenge is just going to be strictly logistical?
I'm pretty confident about that. I think every number that I'm hearing right now, they've announced this so many times. Maybe they'll have to go back on it, Kate. It's possible. But this is what they've announced. By the end of March, we're in March. Today's March 1st. By the end of March, there will be 220 million Moderna and Pfizer vaccines, 220 additional to what we have now, and 20 million J&J. So that's 240 million. Now, of course, the 20 million J&J count as 20 million. The 240 million of the others count as 120 million. That's 110. That's 130 million people of doses in just the month of March. Now, given the fact that they've distributed somewhere around 70 million doses already, and I think something like 15 to 20% of the people have at least one dose, and let's call it 25 to 30% of the people at the moment have no intention of getting vaccinated. That means, if you just add it up, by the end of March, if all of those were in arms, not in arms yet, but if they were all in arms, you might be at 75 to 80% of the people that want to get vaccinated have enough. There's enough vaccine supply by the end of March. So I'm starting to believe April is the time.
So hold on, that Adi has something, but I just want to kind of make sure I understand what you're saying. You've added one more element to consider as we've thought about kind of saturating the population. And that element is we're learning some percentage of people are going to pass on this thing. I think the news in this past week was something like a third of the National Guard folks, young folks who were made eligible and offered the vaccine, right, declined the vaccine. And of course, we've heard anecdotally that that's been going on a lot. So you're saying, look, as we calculate what it's going to take to saturate the population enough to get at least normal life, if not herd immunity, let's back out that percentage that are never going to want it. And by your calculations, your quick, you know, back of the matchbook kind of calculations, you're saying maybe end of March, at least there's enough distributed, if not actually.
Maybe I've got the slope wrong, but if they can make 220 million Pfizer and Moderna by the end of March and 20 million Johnson & Johnson by the end of March, don't you think they can produce at least that many in April? I mean, I would think the answer's got to be yes. Well, that now means we'd have 440 million Pfizer and Moderna doses, which is enough for 220 million people. And Johnson & Johnson's only going up, but let's say 40 million. You now have enough. I mean, you have enough for 260 million people. That's 70% of the U.S., 80% of the U.S. population.
Okay. So, Adi.
I absolutely agree with Eric. I think we're going to have plenty of supply, certainly by the end of April, and I would guess even earlier. And I also think it's going to be the drugstore chains that are going to end up doing most of the heavy lifting because they have the capacity and the ability to do this at scope and scale. Right now, we're really kind of small. The real issue is I'm certain that when we're having these conversations in about 4 to 6 or 8 weeks, the most important thing we're going to be talking about is vaccine compliance, or whatever you want to call it, getting people to do it. A large number of the population, I don't know exactly what the estimates are, and many of them are obviously on the younger side because of don't feel the need. They're going to be vaccine reluctant, and there's a lot of it, and it's diverse and it's very different. And we're gonna end up fighting. We're gonna be talking about messaging about the vaccine. And right now the messaging about getting the benefits of the vaccine are terrible. Just to get ahead of this, and I'm talking to friends whose parents are now vaccinated, and their parents are refusing to see their children because they're scared. And this isn't good messaging. I know we had David Leonard on our show a couple of weeks ago, and he's been talking about it, and there's other people starting to talk about it. But I think we're going to be talking a lot about it in a few weeks, or maybe it's a month, 6 weeks, about the growing reluctance in the country to actually be vaccinated.
To what extent is that recoverable? To what extent are those horses out of the barn and we can't get back because of the way things were politicized a year ago? I have a little bit of a position there, but mostly it's a question. Like, can we change the messaging at this point?
Sorry, go ahead, Shane.
Well, and I was going to say also messaging. I mean, there's also different types of kind of coercion or incentive. If it becomes the case, I think it would be legally very tough in this country. But if it becomes the case where people are starting to get excluded from things they need to show proof of vaccination. I don't know if that, you know, that's a social incentive that people are going to be comfortable with, but that's something that could provide an extra push.
You could say, Shane, for example, look, there's no way, given not just the, I'll call it equal division in our government today, but also the way the Supreme Court is and giving individual rights, which we all believe in individual rights. There's no way they're going to approve it, like mandating vaccine for certain things. However, you could see mandated vaccine if you want to get on an airplane. It's not impossible that you could see that. If you want to go to a large sporting event, like you could imagine certain governors in certain states could say, if you want to go to Yankee Stadium to watch a game, you have to be vaccinated. And if you're not vaccinated, then you can't go. So I'm with you, Shane. If we want to get that last population, I don't think messaging is going to do enough. I think there needs to be some tangible incentive that makes it happen.
And just to clarify, I don't actually want that necessarily. That extra push. That's not something I personally am necessarily advocating for. But
I want to sit here and say we got to take it off the table because we are not going to have such a such a national certification tool. We won't have what in Israel is they're being already creating a green passport. We just do not have the capability to create such a device here in the United States. And I don't think we necessarily want that.
I mean, the pushback on it might be more damaging than the push itself, right?
Absolutely. Well, also, we have these ridiculous white little CDC cards that you get when you get vaccinated that are completely insecure in every level.
Oh, yeah. I would never do it, but you could make that at Kinko's in like a half an hour.
Half an hour with you know, without any knowledge. So yeah. I agree with you. It certainly would be an incentive, but it's not going to happen. So what are we going to do to get people to go?
To say it's not going to happen at the national level is different from saying it's not going to occur, because there are going to be plenty of organizations and event holders who will come up with that kind of
thing. Or right. Employers.
They have every right.
Employers.
They have every right. And employers. And they have every right to. And so they have the challenge then of relying on some means of documentation or certification. So somebody's going to be coming up with these things of varying degrees of quality.
Well, suppose like right now, for example, we noticed the other thing that caught my eye directly related to this, Kate, is that cases and deaths are actually flattening now. This is the first week now in about 6 or 7 weeks that they're not declining. So how about the following? I know this isn't going to incentivize everybody, but how about if that last 30%, I'm making up the number, you said a third, 30% doesn't get vaccinated. How about we're never going to actually get the death rate and the case rate down to this really, really low level? Like maybe it'll stay for another year to 18 months at, I'm making a number up, 50,000 cases and 500 to 1,000 deaths a day. You know, 30% of the U.S. population is still almost 100 million people. 100 million people, a lot of people can die out of 100 million people. A lot of people can get cases. Now, Adi, you're going to say there's no way for the virus to spread, herd immunity, et cetera, except in subpopulations of people where you have localized spreading, you don't need it to jump from one area to another area. In other words, this is how networks work. You could have clusters of people that are tightly knit, that there's lots of spreading localized within a network to which you could still get a significant number of deaths. Now, it can't last forever, but it could last for another year. It could absolutely last for another year.
So, yeah. So just to go to press on that a little bit, you're absolutely right. And you anticipated my objection. You probably saw it on my face.
I did.
Is that the basic idea is once enough people are vaccinated, then we take advantage of the herd immunity, which just drops the R by whatever the fraction of people are unvaccinated, just necessarily. And that's just a huge win. Right now, we're doing it in sections of the population. So the remaining population just isn't seeing enough people that are vaccinated to make reduction. I think the big problem that we'll be seeing in the future are large-ish communities of people who are majority not vaccinated. That's what could keep this around for a long time.
And Adi, you know what? You've talked about this a number of times. You've always talked about how bad people's mathematics and intuition is for exponential growth. Well, it is also for exponential decay. Let's even imagine R drops to 0.9, 0.95. 0.95 to the 12th, let's say it's a monthly R. That's not zero. And you take 100 million people, even a population of 1 million people, and say, all right, so R is less than one. Okay. It ain't going to zero immediately. So my point is that this is why we're seeing a flattening now. And by the way, you have to bring in, let's go back to our uncertainty distribution that we've been talking about. If these new variants become the dominant strain and they're actually more contagious, you might see R starting to go back up. But again, amongst a smaller set of people, it's highly contagious, but within a small set of populations of people that don't want to get vaccinated.
So actually, I think that one of the reasons why things are leveling is that the British variant, the more contagious variants are starting to become the dominant mode.
Exactly.
And so it just is so, and it's also more contagious among the people doing the least to keep it from spreading, because the populations without the vaccines are the youngest. So there are a lot of anti-vaxxers out there, shocker of all things, right, who have been pointing to the Israel data, which I always thought sounds fantastic. I mean, 1 million people, basically no cases among the vaccinated. But in the last week, there's been a plateau there as well. And so they're saying, how could this happen? Is this nothing to do with the vaccine? Because even Israel is plateauing just like all the other countries. But if you actually look at the data, almost all the spread is people under 40. And even among the people under 40, almost all of it is young people. And one of the reasons why is that society's opened up a little bit from a way where it was under lockdown. So as we open up more, and we still have a large fraction of the society without vaccinations, we might end up seeing more cases in the next 2 months.
Absolutely.
So we need to have a network person on here to have this conversation, because someone needs to model, someone is modeling the decline of this thing, just as we use networks to model the rise of it.
And our colleague Duncan Watts wouldn't be a bad person. He knows a little bit about networks.
Let's get Duncan. Honestly, we should probably try to get Duncan, even if we can only get 5 minutes from him. And that might be all we could get. Because I'm working for an intuition for how this thing works on the way down. Because my sense is not the sense you're arguing, Eric. My sense is that you can kind of, if you happen to knock out some key links, some of these super spreader type folks, that you arrest it in more rapidly than you are characterizing, in the same way that it grew that way. If it hit the right person or if it hit the right event, it really grew because people's relationships are very asymmetric. Some folks just have many more contacts than others. So you just by chance knock out one of those people and you're going to arrest its ability to go.
And do we think like this, this kind of rapid decrease that we saw up until the last few days, basically, was that just kind of the holiday wave working its way through? Or was that actually us by vaccinating healthcare workers first, et cetera, actually hitting a lot of these key links in the network?
I think we thought it was kind of overdetermined that it was coming down, but certainly vaccines seem to have made a difference. And the most parsimonious story is that the vaccine decline just ran against the UK variant, South Africa variant, this increased contagiousness. And then we've kind of reached an equilibrium.
Also, I want to keep going back to what Cade, you've been saying all along, is that we don't reflect uncertainty enough. Yeah. I still want to bring in a small probability. I know people don't want to hear it, that the effectiveness of the current vaccines may not be as high against these variants. And number two, now you're talking about the need potentially, and they were already doing this, they're already developing booster shots for the Pfizer and Moderna. So now the question is, are people going to be willing to get, like, you know, let's say Adi's been vaccinated. Is he willing to get another shot every 6 months, or are people willing to do that, which it might take to, you know, over a 2 or 3 year period to really, you know, end this virus as being a serious player. So now you have to build that in as well. So I'm just saying we still have to, I think it's a low probability event, very low, but we've got to build in this mixture distribution that there still are these unknowns out there. And if we don't, we're going to way underestimate the amount of uncertainty.
Yeah. It's always a good exercise, right? Especially with something as complicated as this. Let's enumerate the known unknowns. We can't enumerate the unknown unknowns, but we can at least enumerate the known unknowns. And so that you're pointing us in a good direction, Eric. And in general, what I've heard from you guys today is kind of a move of our focus from we're about to be kind of a wash in vaccine. And so the distribution channels are probably going to change. And then the whole challenge changes as it goes from getting vaccine to convincing people to take it. And I love this concept of, I don't like it as an infringement on civil liberties, but I like the idea that there's going to be a battle fought out there that maybe some organizations in their own interests are going to restrict who can participate in whatever their activity is. And that's going to provide an incentive for some folks to get the vaccine. It's also going to raise the question of how we document and how we certify in a way that's legitimate and compelling.
And I think you guys you've all taken one direction in terms of the encouragement to vaccinate. The idea that if there is activities that some people can do that if they're vaccinated, but you couldn't do if you're not. I'm actually very concerned about people who are vaccinated not changing their behaviors and being a very bad role model, if you will. I don't know how that's the right description for people should I get vaccinated?
Mandated in restaurant dining among the vaccines.
You can't get
Pfizer number two unless we see you at Chili's having a cheeseburger inside.
So I mean, you jest, I think, but what I'm concerned about is people saying, why vaccinated if I can't change my behavior anyway? And there's a lot of that being advertised, and forget about going. Yeah, I mean, I definitely dining out, but I would say seeing relatives. This is something that it's obviously it changes, but I enumerated, I know many people, definitely elder people. And we talked about it on the show. Eric and I were here and talked about my uncle Lenny, I don't want to have an example. He's willing to see relatives, but there are lots of other relatives, aged people been vaccinated who don't want to see their family, or at least not as without 6 feet away or outside, or a lot of the same things that we did all throughout this entire year. And that's sending a message saying, why bother?
I thought you were going to reflect something else, Adi, which is, let's say I go past a restaurant, okay, and I see the restaurant packed, and like, I have no idea who's been vaccinated or not in there. Maybe I think, you know, this thing's over. What do I need to get vaccinated for? I thought you were going to go in a different direction, yeah. Which is, you know, I see a mixture distribution of non-compliers and people that have been vaccinated. I don't know who's who. And I'm just thinking, I guess it's not as much need anymore. Restaurants are open. Things are back to normal.
Yeah. I'm with you, Eric. I think that's much more of a concern than what Adi's saying. I appreciate Adi's been coming at this kind of from the beginning of feeling like people were too blunt in the prescriptions that they were drawing. And I think it was a good battle to fight for a long time. This one, I disagree with him. I'm with Eric. I think the bigger concern, there's just such a move to do these things we've always done our lives. I'm not worried about people resisting that once they have a little more freedom. I share more Eric's concern that people who shouldn't be doing it are going to be pulled into the fray because so many others are. I mean, Odd, what have you done? As soon as you got your second vaccine, you're like off to the movie theater, you know, and like that, you're a human like the rest of people. People want to get back to their normal behaviors.
I do, and I will, but I have to say that I feel like I'm very much in the minority. And this is something that is possibly more upfront for us because of my wife's job and trying to lure people to come back to synagogue. And at this point, there's a fairly sizable fraction of the congregation who has been vaccinated. Obviously, it's a more telling demonstration of the demographic of our community. But very few of them have actually decided that they would go back to synagogues. And I'm sure this is true of churches as well, because they're still concerned. Maybe that, and it's hard to figure that out.
Yeah. And I'll also point out that it's not even like I think we're even framing this sort of like the bad role model kind of thing, that people are just tired of COVID and they just want to get back to normal. It's also people could start being again coerced to get back to normal before they're comfortable. Employers could start again, employers could start, you know, phasing out things like stay at home and everything.
Just to maybe to wrap that point up, Shane, we just received a note today, as you noticed, from our provost, who said, do not expect to come back on the campus until July 1st at the earliest, was exactly the note from today. So I can tell you that the University of Pennsylvania will not be coercing us to come back sooner than they think is safe.
But I'm thinking more like, you know, retail workers, you know, like restaurant workers, et cetera.
Yeah, you know? Right. There will be some organizational coercion in some quarters for sure. All right, guys, that has been the first quarter of Wharton Moneyball. Another week updating each other on our thoughts around COVID-19. And we will return to that again a week from now. We still have three quarters to go and a lot of sports.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. 2 hours of sports analytics here on SiriusXM. Rolling into the second quarter. Open lines, as we used to say, open topic. Lots to talk about. You guys, by the way, can reach out to us between shows. You can reach us on Twitter at WMoneyball. At WMoneyball is our handle on Twitter. Lots of activity up there, and we love to hear from you. Questions, suggestions, ideas, whatever you got. Also, we have a mailbag of sorts. You can email us, moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. That's our email address. It's our mailbag. We love questions there. We try to take them and get them on air as often as possible. moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. Guys, right after we taped last Monday, Tiger Woods had an accident Tuesday morning, and pretty big news in the golf world. He was honored by his fellow golfers this past weekend. Everyone wore red, his signature color. Eric, you've been tracking his career closely from the time he came out. We've been tracking that major counter ticking up and then slowing and then ticking again at the Masters recently. What are you thinking and feeling about what happened with Tiger Woods?
Well, I mean, even before this, remember, he hadn't played since the Masters. That was not the Masters he won, last year's Masters. Mm-hmm. He ended up tied for 38th. He had another surgery in between now and then. It's not clear exactly when he was coming back even this year. He's also 45 years old. I believe there's only been one major ever won by somebody above the age of 45, and it might have been Hale Irwin at the U.S. Open. I think he might have been 46 or something, somewhere in that age range.
Wasn't Nicholas's Masters in the
80s? Nicholas won at 46. 86 also. You're right. In 86, yeah. Nicholas was 46 in 86. He might be the oldest major winner, and Hale Irwin somewhere around there. But the expected number of majors for Tiger Woods was at most expected number, I would say less than one. I mean, the over under, if you had to put an over under line, it would have been under one anyway, additional majors for him to win. And now, I mean, I don't know who would take the over. I don't even, matter of fact, I'm not even sure who would take the over on him winning a golf tournament again.
Well, Eric, real quickly on that point, it's a little piquant as well. I mean, he is the all time, he's tied, I think, is it with Byron Nelson or Sam Snead?
Sam Snead, 82 wins.
Tied all time for number of PGA wins, and that's something that even if you had him under one on majors, you would have bet against, you would not have bet against him never winning a tournament again.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would have bet on him winning a tournament again. Yes, I would,
especially
have.
With that incentive in front.
If he was healthy enough to play, I'll make up a number. If he had played 10 to 15 tournaments a year for the next 5 years until he's 50. If he played 50 to 75 tournaments, Mr. I win 20 to 25% of every tournament I enter. And that's true even since his comeback. It's still true. Yes, I believe Tiger Woods would have won more.
Hold on, Eric. Is that because I knew that was true at his peak. And I remember when he kind of reached it and we were all kind of astounded.
He played a little less. He played, well, remember, he was stuck at 79 wins for a very long time. He then won the year-end tournament, the WGT Championship, the FedEx Cup. He didn't win the FedEx Championship. He won the last tournament in the FedEx Cup. He ended up losing to Justin Rose for the title. He ended up second. He then won the Masters, and he then won the Zozo Championship. So he was stuck at 79. He won three. I would say he played something about – it's obviously a little less than that, but I don't think he played 30 tournaments. I think he won more than 10% of the tournaments he played, even since his, let's say, recovery from his back surgery. Okay. So there's no evidence to suggest if he played 50 more tournaments, he wouldn't have won more than one of those tournaments. But now, let's go back to the thing. It's about coin flips. I don't think he's going to play 50 more tournaments. I don't think he's going to play 20 more tournaments.
It would be an Alex Smith level comeback if he was to actually come back and, I think, compete for at least compete in majors. Maybe winning another tournament is possible.
You know, Eric's pushing us in the COVID section the last few weeks to remember to incorporate enough uncertainty and consider the known unknowns and, you know, maybe, you know, widen those confidence intervals. From the beginning, I have felt like maybe we're a little too sure what's going to happen here. And yes, it's a big strike against him, but we don't really know his prognosis. And my gosh, I mean, people have underestimated his will and character.
Kate, I just said I would take the under. I'm just putting less than 50%. I didn't say I'd give you 100-1 odds against it.
Yeah.
I just said I would take the under. I think his expected number of major wins is less than one, significantly less. And I think his, because again, let's pretend he plays for five more years. He's not playing this year. Okay, so that this year is entirely out. Let's imagine he can come back for next season. Let's imagine it's next year's Masters that he comes back. So he has 4 years left, 3.5 years left until he turns 50. Maybe he could win a match. Look.
Yeah, look what Tom Watson almost did.
Tom Watson, if he had hit a 7-foot putt, was 58 years old and would have won the British Open.
Okay,
and so,
Eric. Exactly.
It's possible. So
let's set aside the major and let's go with the Sam Snead thing. Over under, will he ever win a tournament again? Yes, no, a number of tournament wins to take the all-time record from Sam Snead. Guys, all around.
Yes, over. I think he wins another tournament.
Over half.
I'm going with under. I don't think he's ever going to win another tournament.
And I'm going to go with under because I don't think he will be healthy enough to play enough tournaments to make it so that the expected number is greater than zero.
I mean, he was fragile already.
Correct. He wasn't playing, Adi. He hadn't played since the Masters that was retooled to October. He hadn't played in 6 months, and he hadn't even picked up a golf club before the accident.
Hey, actually, kind of golf question. Is there many other tournaments that are like the Masters where previous champions get an auto entry?
Well, the answer is yes.
That guy's going to get all the auto entries.
Right. I mean, like I assume he'll get invited whenever he wants to play, frankly.
It used to be – so, Shane, it used to be you got lifetime exemptions to all of them. They changed that. I think some of them might be age 60 or 65, but he's got at least another 15 years of exemption at the British, U.S. Open, PGA. But as Cade said, he's playing every tournament he wants.
So let's stay in the blast from the past segment here and golf. And on the women's side, Annika Sorenstam showed up all of a sudden. And I didn't even know she was going to compete. So what's going on with that, Eric?
Well, let's be clear. This is the only tournament. She's now 50. She hadn't played any tournaments, not a major. She hadn't played any tournaments for 13 years. And this happened to be an LPGA tournament on her home course. So she decided that she would play.
Which is where, by the way?
It's somewhere in Florida. I don't remember the name of her home course. It was the Genesis Open or something. I don't remember the name of it. It's on her home course. She made the cut. Now, she made the cut exactly on the cut line. She ended up last after four rounds, but she did make the cut after not playing for 13 years. She says she's training now because she wants to play on the senior LPGA events.
Okay.
She actually put it an interesting way. She said, I have too much respect for the LPGA for me to come out of retirement and try to play a tournament here or there. They're just better than I am.
Okay, fair enough.
But I thought that was amazing that she actually – I understand it's her home course, but she still made the cut.
Yeah, it's fun. It's very fun. At 50, way to go, Annika. All right, guys, a story we didn't get to last week that is just mind-blowing to – I mean, I think it's mind-blowing to y'all, and you pay attention to someone who's not paying attention. It's utterly hard to understand. This Tatis deal that the Padres did. Can you
update? Yeah.
Tatis? Is Tatis? Oh, I'm sorry, my bad. Tatis. So – ridiculous contract for a guy who's not played much baseball. Can you update us on what's going on here and how are the Padres thinking about this?
Well, I just looked at the numbers of the contract. I'll just say one thing. I know Adi wants to jump in. They signed him to a 14-year, $340 million contract. And I just want to comment. Last year, he had .277. He was 18th in the league in OPS. But here's the kicker. This is the major kicker. In his entire career, not last year, in his entire career, he's played 143 games, so less than one season of baseball games, and he's got a 14-year, $340 million contract. I'm not good with that.
Okay, hold on. Let me push a little technicality. It's more than a technicality. To what extent can a guy's pre-major performance forecast his major performance? So you say 143. That's major league games. Where did he come from? He must have been either in.
He was highly touted throughout, and I like the way you're going with this, Cade, because I think the only way it's somewhat justifiable is that he basically, I think, in part earned this, you know, because he basically has met there's high expectations put on him, and he has thus far met them.
And by the way, I mean the forecasting. This would be a good topic for someone out of Major League Baseball, but it's not like it's throwing darts from these other leagues. And they got years of data on other leagues, even international leagues at this point. And so there is pretty good signal out of those systems, and especially the Major League farm system.
Yeah, the truth. Listen, Tatis was highly touted when he was in the farm system, and he broke out like a house of fire. But on the other hand, this is a movie we've seen before, right? So it doesn't have to play out that. And this is an enormous dollar sign. And also, usually the teams feel that they get a lot of value out of these players when they got them locked up for 6 years at essentially market value. Right. And you'd argue, let's go 3 years, see if he gets 3 years out of this before he goes for 14. This is an enormous expenditure, but I have to say it really says that Padres want to win.
Oh, but hold on. What was Padres' incentive for doing this? Because you usually do. I mean, it's contractual. How many years you have a guy before he hits free agency, and they even manipulate this by keeping him in the farm system until June or whatever. But there's usually this pretty nice window they have. Yeah. Why did they accelerate that?
Well, I mean, I think the justification is if they really do have such a high opinion of him, they believe that this is going to be his forecast going forward. He's only going to get more expensive as time goes on. So, for example, the Red Sox, you know, you could argue retrospectively gave Mookie Betts too much time to demonstrate his incredible value and essentially lost him as a consequence. I'm not justifying the deal. I'm just kind of, I think, presenting at least the counterfact, you know, kind of a counterpoint here.
So let me just ask the following. Let's suppose we took his numbers from 2020. He played 60 games. Obviously, it was a shortened season. But let's multiply by 2.5, which gets him to 150 games. If I told you, if you multiply by 2.5, he'd end up with roughly 40 home runs, 110 RBIs. his OPS obviously would stay the same. It would be about 940. If he was a 40-110 guy for the next 8 to 10 years, you'd say that was a pretty darn good contract. So he doesn't even have to get better. You could argue most 22-year-olds get better in baseball, not worse. He's 22. So even if he gives them an average of 8 years to 10 years at his current level of play, I think we'd all say if he's a 4,100 guy for 8 to 10 years, that's a pretty damn good deal.
So this is interesting. I know you're just back the enveloping it, but I appreciate what you're doing there. And this age thing is what I think is most interesting. So you started this segment, Eric, by saying we've seen this movie before. But in fact, the movie that I've most often seen on these big contracts is when they go to guys who are 30, 31, 32. And then the out years are just ridiculous. You know, they're in the retirement home and they're still.
Albert Pujols is in the last year of his 10-year, $300 million deal, or $250 million, that he's literally now in the last year of this 10-year deal.
Is Bobby Bonilla still being paid?
Yeah, he is. But that's Bobby Bonilla is still being paid.
That's a different contract.
But that's a different concept. But listen, so the major leagues have gotten smart. That's no more 10-year, 12-year, 14-year contracts to 29-year-olds. That seems to be disaster. But now they're trying the 13-year contract for the 21, 22-year-olds. I don't know, where does Mookie Betts fit in on this? I mean, he got paid more for about as more time, but he had 5 years of – how many years did Mookie Betts have of insanely good performance?
At least three and a half, four. I can't remember now.
I mean,
at least 4 years. And he won an MVP. He was already MVP. Yeah. He was already, you know, et cetera.
Tatis got the same money, more or less, same ballpark money as Mookie Betts. Yeah. Really?
No, that's – I mean, it's making that Mookie Betts deal suddenly look very cheap, I guess, in retrospect.
Yeah.
Okay, so hold on. So comparing it to Mookie, because that was just signed last year, right? And so that's nice. But it's just one comparison, but it's a good point. But let's set it aside for the moment. Let me ask you another question. I mean, these teams are pretty sophisticated. They're very sophisticated. The analytics, the modeling, the forecasting they do on players these days. What do we know? I mean, I think we four don't know how much signal and how tight that forecast is after you've seen a guy for 140 games. It doesn't seem like much to us, but is it possible, fellas, is it possible that performance can be extreme enough, especially when they're only 22, that even with a relatively small sample, that the expectation can get pretty high and you might start justifying some pretty big contracts?
I have to say, particularly with injury as an extremely important potential forecast problem, and this is not a sport where you don't get paid if you're on the bench or if you're on the injured reserve.
Well, they have insurance policies, but yep.
Yeah, and so I'm actually kind of I feel like it's early. I mean, we've seen this with many players who do very well early on, and then they find themselves spending a lot of time, injured. Maybe I'm thinking about Aaron Judge.
Hold on, injuries.
Giancarlo.
Are you saying that's just an argument against long contracts, right? Because are you saying no? We need to learn about injury proneness is persistent.
This is actually a potential research and question that I don't know the answer to, which is, can I predict your injury prevalence from an early forecast?
Okay. That sounds valid, and that sounds really interesting to me. Yes.
But I want to bring up something else. Maybe what we shouldn't also just be thinking about is, this has been studied in baseball too, which is maybe it's not chronological age also. It's kind of, wear and tear age, which is maybe a 32-year-old Fernando Tatis, who then will have played 12 full seasons by the age of 32. Let's compare that with Wade Boggs, who was sitting behind Carney Lansford, who didn't really play until he was 27. So age 32 for Boggs was 5 or 6 seasons, but age 32 for Tatis is 12 seasons. Also, most players decline after age 32 or 33. So even in the best case scenario, potentially, those last 4 years, you say, well, he's really young. Well, until age 36? Really? So let me just say, they better have a very good 10-year block, and they better hope that the average of those 10 years is somewhere near where he is now. Because I understand it's just 2 years. You understand, he had a much better 2019 than he had 2020. So you'll say, well, it's going to be the average of the two. Well, I understand it's just 2 points. Suppose I tell you now his 2021 is worse than his 2020. You say, well, it's just 3 points. It's not a real decline yet. Well, at some point, let me just tell you, 2021 is worse than 2020. We'll be talking about this a year from now and saying, look at that contract.
One other thing to throw in is that the fact that he's a major league legacy, does that play into our forecast of future?
Oh, of course.
Of course, it does.
Guy
or right or wrong, you know.
The other thing worth bringing up is you know, the value, the future value of this deal is not just based on his future performance, but it's also based on how baseball deals in the future are going to evolve, right? So again, if you're trying, if you're making a bet of kind of a lot of inflation in baseball salaries in the future, I wouldn't necessarily make that bet. I think coming out of COVID, we at least for a few years, we might see a lot of deflation, in fact, which makes the deal that much more questionable. But that's at least something worth considering.
But just to show you a comparison, okay? Albert Pujols, one of the greatest players of all time, if you look at his statistics, okay? In his since age 32, he's been a 257 hitter, and he's averaged 25 home runs a year. So I just want to comment. That's Albert Pujols. Now,
his OBP is still pretty amazing, right? No, I mean, he still gets on base.
No. Fact, it's in the stats I put. He's had eight straight seasons with an OBP below 333. Eight straight seasons with an on-base below 333. No, he's not even getting on base anymore.
Put a value on that kind of consistency, Eric.
Yeah, well, there you go. That's a very good point. But my point is, Fernando Tatis Jr. is no Albert Pujols. There's no way you could predict. I'm not saying he can't be, but there's no way you could predict him to be one of the greatest 20 hitters of all time, which Albert Pujols clearly was for his first 10 to 12 seasons. He clearly was. Every advanced metric says that.
Yeah, so, and I mean, like Mookie Betts, since we brought him up as comparison, like he had actually 5 seasons worth of data before his deal.
And he's not Pujols either.
MVP 4 out of those 5, MVP top 10 MVP voting 4 out of those 5 seasons.
Just, you know, one thing that Cade brought up was the idea that their teams are too smart to be making a mistake. I actually think I think there's a big gap still between where the smart core of the analytics on each team, baseball's got a ton of them. There's still a little bit of a wall that separates the analytics community and the top management, particularly ownership, which eventually makes these decisions.
That's very fair. And of course, I don't have any insight into the Padres organization. I would never say that we can't criticize or we can't even question the decisions of these teams because they have a bunch of analysts. That's not the way it works. But I think it's interesting to think about. I'd love to know what their forecasts were saying and what they're based on. All right, guys, that has been 2 quarters of Wharton Moneyball. We still have 2 quarters to go.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. 2 hours of sports analytics on Sirius XM. We do this every week, recording on Monday afternoon, March 1st. It's March, people. This thing will go up on Wednesday. Got the whole crew here. Audie Weiner is here. Shane Jensen is here. Eric Brattle is here. And this is Cade Massey. Eric's teaching right now. Shane's teaching right now. Audie is, I'm not even going to tell you what Audie's doing right now. You're going to be jealous. We are here for your comments. Hit us up on Twitter at WMoneyball. Hit us up on email, moneyball@wharton.upenn.edu. We got about 20 minutes here in the third quarter to talk about anything on your mind, fellas. Something that caught my eye was, of course, football related. Mel Kiper has a new mock draft out. I think it's his second. And he did something unusual. He put trades into his first round forecast for the first time. He's saying, look, there's a lot of QBs. There are some QB hungry teams. I bet they make some moves. So he put them down. But the exciting bit, which is going to keep us all talking for the next 2 months anyway, the draft is at the end of April. Kiper has 5 QBs going in the top 10. What do you think? Fun? Interesting?
I think it's a little bit of an odd year for that. I mean, I feel like the talent of these QBs does not beget them all being top 10 pick. Like I assume some part of this is somehow like the fact that there's so much uncertainty across so many teams at quarterbacks.
I don't know. I think there's excitement about these guys. I do think okay. there has to hit a certain level to be top 10, but it's not that high. I mean, quarterback is such a valued position, and there are enough teams always on the search. I mean, look, this is going to sound funny to say after the fact, but Pat Mahomes, there were a lot of questions about Pat Mahomes. There were people who flat out did not think he was an NFL quarterback, and he was a top 10 draftee.
I'm still skeptical. I'm kidding. I have eyes. I don't think you can have eyes and be skeptical at this point. But
the interesting thing about this list, it starts with Trevor Lawrence, of course, Zach Wilson. People weren't that big on Zach Wilson.
Yeah, he's jumped up on everybody's big board to at least the second chosen quarterback, whether he goes second or not, whether there's a trade or not, that's debatable. But he's the second chosen quarterback now, jumping Justin Fields from OSU.
Yeah, Justin Fields, people have been talking about, you know, since he came out of high school. So that's not a surprise. But Mac Jones, nobody was talking about Mac Jones this time last year. Right. And he just blew the doors off everybody this past season. And then the North Dakota State quarterback who only got to showcase his wares for one game. North Dakota State literally played one game in the fall, more or less transparently. So they wanted to get him a little bit of airtime because he's been kind of an intriguing prospect. He's the Carson Wentz of this year's draft with even less to show from his college time.
One dynamic, too, that must be affecting the draft is I feel like this offseason, at least in terms of talk, maybe not in terms of actual action, but there's a lot more kind of established quarterbacks somehow in contention to be going to other teams, you know, and like that's got to be at least minimally distracting to teams that are looking, you know, planning their drafts out and stuff like that. So I kind of wonder if, you know, if some of these established quarterbacks, because the thing with established quarterbacks moving around is the teams that they're moving from are not necessarily, you know, most of the teams with the top draft choices, the top 10 picks are not the ones with the established quarterbacks.
Mm-hmm. Look, I think you've said it every year, Kate. What could easily happen is we all believe at the moment Trevor Lawrence is going to be taken with the first pick. Let's even take that as a given for now. It doesn't have to be because Jacksonville could trade. Someone could order them a bucket load. Well, it'll be taken probably with the first pick by some other team. But let's just say he's taken with the first pick. If all of a sudden Wilson and Fields are off the board, like in the top 3, 4, 5 picks, there could be a run. I mean, this is what happens. You know, I'm a team. Yeah. I need a quarterback. And now all of a sudden it's not, I'm not getting Lawrence. I'm not getting Wilson. I'm not getting Fields. Now all of a sudden Mac Jones is looking like the next coming of Tom Brady. By the way, I even read an article that said he's Tom Brady. I'm like, oh my God, Bobby, come on. I mean, you know, I don't know. I mean, but I'm just saying you could imagine him getting drafted higher. If there's 3 or 4 quarterbacks, if the first 3 picks were all quarterbacks, let's just say that happens, who knows? All of a sudden, Mac Jones may go 5. Sure he could. Why not?
Yeah, say real quickly, let's do an aside on this. You just said he's not going to be Tom Brady, just like you said Tatis is not
gonna be Albert Pujols.
So, we know from a forecasting perspective, you need to be regressive. You just don't make forecasts that are that extreme. But, you know, what if there's real payoff to nailing when there is that guy? What if, you know, it's not that optimal forecast comes from some loss function that says you don't want to be long from right. And a little bit wrong is not that big a deal, but you really don't want to be way wrong. What if teams feel differently? What if they're willing to be more risk tolerant? What if they really don't want to miss out on the next Tom Brady?
They absolutely should be risk tolerant. They should be, especially when it comes to quarterback, because if you're wrong, then I hate to say it, you'll stink next year, this year, and you can grab another quarterback next year. But if you're right, and now, remember, quarterback's not like I say, you know, they don't have the lifespan of other players. Quarterback can be 10, 12 years plus. If you're right, mm-hmm. The payoff is huge.
Yeah.
And by the way, I have no problem with teams drafting quarterbacks multiple years in a row. And by the way, you would not shock me if the Dolphins, who have Tua, they may trade Tua. They may draft another quarterback to compete with Tua. I'm not putting any of the, they've got a quarterback they just drafted in the top 5 last year. I could care less. I still think they could draft a quarterback.
Yeah, I totally agree with Eric. And he basically made the point I was going to, that I think, you know, Arizona, I think, kind of set I think the concept of sunk cost has now been a little bit better, like has made it a little bit more into the kind of planning, you know, as far as drafting goes. And I mean, I agree, the value of grabbing a franchise quarterback is hard to measure, really. Almost.
Also, Shane, let's
and so
this.
I mean, maybe you just kind of talk yourself into like, let's just buy as many of these high-end lottery tickets, you know, spend as many of these high-end lottery tickets on quarterback as possible.
Oh, but let's also remember, let's say the Dolphins did decide to draft a quarterback in the top five. It's not like if they trade Tua, they're getting nothing for him either. Let's remember, he's still an asset. So it's not like if they end up having to trade someone they just drafted, it's not like the Cardinals got nothing for Rose. You know, you could just trade him.
Yeah. Can I ask you guys to invoke your football expertise and tell me a little bit about how long it takes before you draft a quarterback until you know that they could potentially be that franchise quarterback? Is it always obvious or does it take time? Do you have to build? I mean, where are you guys on this?
It's confounded by the fact that, like, you know, they're walking and sometimes they sort of sit for their first, you don't necessarily get a first season playing time. That said, when quarterback, you know, I mean, when quarterbacks like get their first in their first season, get that playing time and look very impressive, like Herbert or Burrow. You know, I mean, you got to really up the. I mean, I think Cincinnati and San Diego, LA, are like definitely coming out of this last season being like, we got one.
Yeah. So here's my answer, Adi. I don't want to just see their play on the field. I want to see every play in practice. And I'm going to tell you something. If I saw every play in practice and their work ethic and they're in the weight room and in the film room, I'm giving an opinion. I think you can tell very quickly. I would say certainly less than 2 years. And I would think if you want to talk about real greatness, you can probably tell within a year and a half.
But just one counterpoint, Carson Wentz.
I never thought Carson Wentz was that great a quarterback.
Well, they thought he was a franchise quarterback.
No, I understand that, but I never thought I thought you could absolutely win a Super Bowl with Carson Wentz, but I never put him in the elite category. As when I say elite, I'm referring to like the Breezes, the Bradys, the Manning.
You mean Hall of Famers?
Well,
franchise quarterback, you got to include like, you know, the like franchise quarterbacks even includes people like Andy Dalton, you know, and then, you know, I guess I have a wider bound on what I call a franchise quarterback. I probably named the most marginal franchise quarterback.
People thought more highly of Carson Wentz than that. I mean, people were
Eric may not have ever thought he was a franchise quarterback. I didn't think he was an elite.
But there are going to be exceptions to any rule, and mostly I'm with Eric. I think the teams are with Eric and thinking that they can see a lot in the first year.
Yeah.
I mean, the stories they tell about Mahomes in practice. It wasn't that they saw him on the field late in year one. It was what they saw in practice.
Exactly.
In year one. Now, what I would say is I want to push it the other way and say it depends on who they're surrounded by, what system they're in. I mean, we're talking about how a team evaluates their fit. If you're somebody else in the league and you're looking across at a team saying, do I ever want that guy? Do I want to hire Carson Wentz? It's a whole different question. Yeah. I mean, we've been talking about this with Sam Darnold for a couple of years now. I was like, can we really judge Sam Darnold given what he was surrounded by and given the coaching staff there and the system?
No.
I kind of don't think we can. And that's despite having seen, you know, 48 games from him or some crazy.
No, and I mean, we also have uncertainty about people like Marcus Mariota is a quarterback that's come up a lot in kind of discussions, you know, as somebody who might have, you know, in his backup duties, played himself into potentially a starting role somewhere.
We did see
a lot of Marcus Mariota not working in the Titan system, and we saw somebody succeeding right after him. So that didn't speak well to his abilities, but maybe he's worthy of a second shot.
I was going to give a different contrast to what you just said, Cade. There must be something that Sam Darnold is doing extraordinarily well in practice. The fact that they're still considering him, despite having the number two pick in the draft, they must see something that we're not seeing on the field, or they believe that if they put a better line around him, he could play better. Because based on his pure performance in games, you would say draft someone else with the number two pick. So they must be seeing something.
Well, or it's a smoke screen, and they actually have seen exactly what you say, and they're definitely going to take a quarterback at number two. We don't actually know what their thinking is on this, but
I don't think
their incentive guide is to telegraph it early.
Let me take the same question to a different place. Are we far enough in the NBA season to call some teams legit or not? Because the leaderboard and the perceptions have been bouncing around a fair bit. I mean, there for a while, people were saying the Nets were the, you know, the second coming of the Golden State Warriors or something. And then I'm always surprised by some of these teams that are just crushing it according to some of the stats. I mean, the Jazz, who plays for the Jazz? I mean, I'm just an outsider.
Donovan Mitchell, Rudy Gobert.
Yeah, I know there's some players, but it's just, you don't expect them to be crushing the, what they're at least analytically. And so I'm curious what we know and what we think we know about the NBA at this point in the season.
Well, this is my opinion. I mean, the Jazz, besides having the best record, they're over 3 points a game, plus minus, better than any other team in the West. And the only team that's even close to them is the Milwaukee Bucks, by the way, in the East. Uh-huh. And they're 2.5 points better. That's a massive gap. Now, here's the thing. If I thought that the NBA regular season mattered a lot, I would start to wonder, maybe the Jazz are really good. But I'm thinking, you know, I don't know if, you know, the Lakers, so Anthony Davis is out and he doesn't really play much. And the team I'm less down, here's the team I would sell short right now. Something's wrong with the Los Angeles Clippers. And I don't know if it's Paul George, like he can't win at the end of games, but I have no faith the Los Angeles Clippers are going to win the NBA title despite all the talent that they have. I don't like the look of that team at all. I don't even think they're going to get to the Western Conference Finals. I'm not positive on that team whatsoever. None.
Well, what about the other Los Angeles team? They're in a little bit of a rut right now as well. Do you think LeBron will pull it out whenever LeBron needs to pull it out?
I think it's not a question. I don't think – I've seen no deterioration in LeBron's game. I think the question is, it gets back to what Adi said about Tatis too, injuries. Is Anthony Davis going to come back 100% healthy? You could say the same thing about the big three. Remember, in the Nets, you talked about the Nets. Kevin Durant has been out for weeks with a hamstring injury. Mm-hmm. How much does he come back? Kyrie Irving's got a bad back. He hasn't played in a couple games. Right now, it's just James Harden playing. If all three of them are healthy, they have to be the heavy, heavy, heavy favorite in the East. Mm-hmm. If all three of them are healthy. Mm-hmm. That's the question. The Lakers, no, I'm not that convinced.
What do you make of our Sixers here in Philadelphia, Eric?
No. How many times do I have to tell you, Adi? I'm going to say it for the thousandth time here. When the best player on your team by far is your center, you are not going to win in today's game the NBA title because you can't get the ball to Joel Embiid at the end of crucial games early enough that it makes that much of a difference. So, no, the Sixers are ill-conceived because Ben Simmons and Tobias Harris, which is our second and third best players, are not good enough. That's the problem. Joel Embiid is good enough for 10 players. Our second and third, not good enough.
Ben Simmons is not a star?
He's not good enough to be an, you know, Adi, we talk about this all the time. It's like in baseball.
We can't score.
It's like, who's your second best player? It's him. Right. He's not good enough for a second best player as a scorer. We can't score enough.
So, Eric, how many people in the league would qualify as a better option than Embiid? How big is that set if they want to bring in another player? Otherwise, they deal – Embiid and start over, right? If your theory is really that strong.
This is my prediction. Remember, by the way, the Sixers were an inch away. Our guy, Daryl Morey, was an inch away, as everyone has said, from trading Ben Simmons as part of the James Harden trade. The Sixers could have gotten James Harden instead of the Nets getting James Harden. He decided not to trade away Ben Simmons. But you're asking me, if the Sixers don't at least make the Eastern Conference Finals this year, my belief, it's a belief, it's an opinion, the Ben Simmons, Joel Embiid experiment is over. The Sixers will realize Embiid and Simmons, they cannot win together with them because one's a big man and the other's a non-scorer. And I think they will have to go in a different direction.
Let me just follow up question, Adi, real quick. Eric, do you think that's more likely to happen because Morey has moved into power with the Sixers? Is he less wedded to that roster because he didn't build it?
I think he's also wedded to analytics. And he sees that while when Ben Simmons is on the floor, the Sixers are a better team, but not because of his shooting. And so I think as an analytics-driven person, a guy that takes no three-pointers at the guard position, he will see that as a liability that they can't actually overcome.
Okay, Eric, you just mentioned analytics as a way of looking at this problem. I would like to challenge you because you do preach this particular rhyme often, and you've even preached it enough that I've begun to just believe it. But if you were going to operationalize it and test it, tell us how you'd do that.
Test the value of Ben Simmons?
No, more specifically, that you can't win in the NBA these days if your number one scoring threat is a big man. So give us the empirical study that would prove that out one way or the other.
Yeah, I'll just follow up before you answer that, Eric, because you've pointed out almost with a corollary, which may be necessary as part of the theorem, that if your number two guy can't shoot.
Yeah, that's kind of what it comes down to, because Embiid's going to be number one, just given who he is, unless you have someone like James Harden. So I just want to I like the theory, but you're recognizing it's just theory. So now I want to know what the study is, because lots of folks could run it, actually.
Let's imagine. Okay, well, let's imagine we just did the following. I love the question. Let's imagine we just made it so that we had a way to measure who the best player on the team was. Whether you want to call it wins above replacement, plus minus, a real field goal percent, however you want to measure who the best player on the team is. Let's run a regression or a machine learning model if we want to look for nonlinearities, where we relate either some outcome measure, could be winning the championship, or it could be wins in a season, because again, there's not that many teams that win the championship, so I don't want to restrict myself to such a small sample. Let's even say make the conference finals.
Let's do playoff wins. Playoff wins.
All right, playoff wins is fine, Shane. I'm happy to do with that. Number of wins in playoffs, and let's use one of the covariates as being, is the best player on your team your center? And then of course, we have to control for all kinds of other variables, etc. I think we would find that, I think here's what we'd find. It's very correlated with playoff wins, but not very correlated with winning the championship. And by the way, this is, Kay, the exact analysis you asked me about is one of the last analysis I did for the Philadelphia Eagles, which was, it's almost like an ordinal regression. If you're trying to predict a playoff team, certain variables matter. But if you're trying to predict winning the championship, a different set of variables matter. So having Joel Embiid as your best player will definitely add to wins in the regular season. It will definitely add to playoff wins, but it won't add to the probability of winning the title.
Are we stuck then because we just don't have enough championships observed, especially not when you're conditioning on NBA these days? So it's even a recent regime. So now we have 10 champions. That's not enough data to run the study.
The effect size isn't going to be big enough to have power against with so few observations.
Okay, so we know that to be true, but we don't want to just punt. So it raises a question of what do you do, especially if you are a team, because the team's going to run the analysis, but then they also have to make the decision. They can't just punt.
Well, you can do what Shane did, which is very reasonable.
Yeah, you can borrow strength from previous regimes, maybe with some kind of linear trend or something like that.
Or pick a broader outcome measure, which what you did, Shane, which is very reasonable to do.
Well, I love the hypothesis, even though it's a dim one for the local team and our friend Maury, who's recently in power. So it's going to be very interesting to see what happens with those guys. All right, guys, that has been another three quarters. We're three quarters into the show. Of course, our interview segment coming up. We warmed up on basketball. We'll talk more basketball, especially college basketball, in the next segment. We've got Ken Pomeroy joining us. He's kind of a regular feature this time of year, going to give us some tips going into March and the March Madness tournament. That has been three quarters. We still have a quarter to go.
You're listening to Wharton Moneyball
on Business Radio.
Welcome back. Welcome back to Wharton Moneyball. Rolling into the fourth quarter now, traditionally, at least for the last year, traditionally our interview segment. We are delighted in this week to welcome back Ken Pomeroy. Ken is a regular guest on our show. We've been doing this for 7 years, and it wouldn't surprise me if we've had Ken 7 years. But almost an annual event to check in with Ken this time of year as we all start thinking about the basketball tournament. It is March. We're recording this on Monday, the first day of March 2021, and we are delighted to have a chance to talk to Ken Pomeroy. Afternoon, Ken. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Kate. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Ken, as many of our listeners know, is one of the forerunners on college basketball analytics. He, in the early 2000s, came up with a better way to look at teams and rank teams, and has been influential in that field since then. He is the founder of KenPomeroy.com or KenPom.com. KenPom.com is a way to find his website, but the Pomeroy rankings have been influential rankings for 15 years at least now. Ken, remind us a little bit of background. First, tell us where you are. Where are you based these days? Is it the same place you were based pre-COVID? What is your daily life looking like right now?
Yeah, still based out of Salt Lake City. So just kind of waiting for things to warm up here so we can all get outside and stretch our legs again. But that's where I'm based out of, and been based there, you know, as you mentioned, for you know, more or less the last 12, 13 years, something like that. And in a normal year, it'd be a great place to be based for college basketball. You know, just about every Western conference is represented by one of the teams out here locally. But obviously this year, I've not been able to get out to any games. So it's been frustrating in that regard.
So this is something we don't usually talk about with our analysts, and I'm curious to hear more. Even though this is an unusual year, you are avid college basketball game goer. You're not watching. You're in a situation where you can actually go see them in person. Is that right?
Correct. Yeah, I would probably go to, I don't know, a dozen games in person, and then go to the Pac-12 tournament, which is in Vegas. Yeah. You know, there's a number of conference tournaments that would be in Vegas the next 2 weeks and are going to be in Vegas. And then, you know, probably hit up the Final Four as well. It would be a normal part of my year. But, you know, obviously – oh, that pretty much scrubbed. I mean, I could have gone to a couple games if I wanted. They're allowing you know, media at these games and fans now in some of these places. But yeah, I just haven't felt the need to do that this year.
Ken, talk to us about your evolution professionally. You were originally a meteorologist, and then at some point you're shifting over to doing college basketball analytics. For some people, that transition is not obvious. Can you tell us a little bit how you moved from meteorology to college basketball analytics?
Sure. Yeah, I've always had an interest in predicting things, and really predicting the weather is probably the most profound thing you can predict. Like, everybody's affected by the weather, some in, you know, major ways. And so, you know, making successful predictions about the weather can, you know, be something that is, you know, makes you feel really good about just kind of helping people, whether it's right, plan events or save lives, you know, in the most profound case. So,
yep.
So that's where this all stemmed from. And, you know, eventually, obviously, my love of college basketball also led to wanting to predict college basketball outcomes and predict who the best teams were and how teams would succeed going forward. And so that's where the rating system really got started.
Mm-hmm. Do you have an allegiance? Was there a team that you grew up pulling for, or are you still especially interested in some teams?
So, you know, I have degrees from Virginia Tech and Wyoming, and for the most part, neither team has had a ton of success, you know, nationally in college basketball. Virginia Tech is a quasi-regular, you know, tournament team, but Wyoming is not, and neither team is going to a Final Four anytime soon or anything like that. So mm-hmm. I'm kind of a free agent when it comes to being a fan, and every year I just kind of gravitate towards teams that that interest me with respect to their either style of play or public misperceptions or things like that. So it kind of varies from year to year which teams I follow closely.
Well, I'm always looking forward to this segment because I feel like you can give us little clues on teams to keep an eye on for the tournament. So we're going to get there. Public misperceptions is one of the things you traffic in. What tools and, or at least what ways of thinking did you bring over from meteorology when you came to write down some power rankings and analyzing teams?
Well, the main thing is just more of a probabilistic way of thinking. So obviously in forecasting the weather, people are familiar with the fact that, you know, your weather forecast is going to contain a chance of precipitation. You know, you rarely hear that, hey, it's going to rain or it's going to snow at this time. It's going to end at this time. Everything is kind of probabilistic in that sense because it's very difficult to predict. And I kind of took the same approach to college basketball where, you know, all of my predictions, you know, they have a score, but the score is more of an expectation. It's not a ironclad prediction, obviously. Mm-hmm. And all the predictions contain a probability, and those probabilities are used to, you know, project a team's record, you know, a dozen games down the road or whatever, you know, just understanding that upsets do occur. And just because you're a 1-point favorite, obviously there's a pretty large chance that you'll lose that game because, you know, mm-hmm. 1-point favorite is not a guaranteed win.
Mm-hmm. You know, weather forecasters, they're famous in the decision-making community, have been for decades now because of an early study that was done on how well calibrated they are. They were kind of celebrated as calibrated. And the idea was it's because they get feedback on their predictions more regularly and in more concrete terms than almost anybody else. But one of the only other domains where feedback is quite that good is in sports. I've thought for years now that sports gamblers are probably professional sports gamblers. Are probably about as well calibrated as weathermen. So talk to me a little bit about when you first built this model, especially since you're a basketball fan and you're going to games. I mean, that experience of writing down models, making predictions, and then going out and seeing them play and seeing getting wrong, getting it right. As a weather person, historically, you're accustomed to being wrong and right, but now you're looking at it and you're seeing things on the court that may or may not be in your model. So I'm guessing in those early years, there was an evolution of this thing. Can you talk about how your model how you navigated the analytical modeling side with the real world experience.
Yes. So yeah, you mentioned meteorology, and one of the great things about it is you get feedback, but that feedback is very public often, you know, when you forecast, right? Like, you know, people don't know necessarily you are a meteorologist, but when you go out in public, like, you're going to just overhear conversations about people talking about how the forecast was blown or something like that. And, you know, you get that feedback in basketball too. Like, obviously if you have a very public rating system, people make fun of your predictions when they're wrong. So, the way to evaluate your predictions is obviously not from the public. It is from the actual scores of games and the outcomes of games and watching teams. I'm not going to say I use the eye test, but there certainly is a reality where you have, you know, your ratings say this team is like an elite team, and then you watch them play and they play a very bad game, and you have to sort of confront the fact that are they really an elite team, or was this their bad game, or was this a game more representative of how they play? In college basketball in particular, there's a huge rush to jump on a particular game outcome and, you know, ascribe real meaning to it, when in reality you probably need, you know, you need to hold your tongue on a lot of these cases and watch, you know, or get data for a team from many, many games before you know really their true identity and whether your predictions are accurate or not.
Mm-hmm. Man, that challenge has never seemed bigger than this year in college basketball. College basketball got to watch all these other sports in North America navigate the pandemic. And then when they launched off, they immediately stubbed their toe, and then they stubbed every other toe in the first couple of months. And there's just been a lot of stretches of teams not playing, the big games getting washed out. What has that meant for your model? And have you tried to address it at all? Or it's just like, hey, this year, what can I do? It's just going to be noisier.
Yeah, I've kind of taken the latter attitude, but there's no question that, you know, so I do measure my model's performance on a daily basis. That's posted, you know, publicly on my site. And I guess the one measure that applies here is the mean average error of my predictions.
Okay.
This year for the season, it's at 9.2 points per game. Last season it was 8.9. The year before that it was at 8.9. The year before that it was at 8.9. So you can see there's, you know, some consistency there until this season, and it's gotten a little worse. That'll improve, actually, you know, as we get further into the season, we have more data, so the predictions will get slightly better.
Yeah.
But there's not much season left. So, you know, maybe I'll go from 9.2 to 9.1 or something like that. But there's been a clear difference in the accuracy, but it hasn't been overwhelming. And overall, I'd say I'm fairly pleased with how the predictions have gone, given, as you mentioned, the circumstances of all the player absences and teams taking breaks and teams not having enough data, you know, where they're playing fewer games as well. So you just wouldn't expect the ratings to be as good.
Well, let's put it the other way then. Is it possible that, given how noisy the season has been, it's ever more important to have a good model, and that we're going to be fooled by our eyes and the headlines more readily because there's fewer games to watch?
Absolutely. And, you know, one of this season has been a great stress test on, you know, on my system, on the code behind the system, ingesting data, how that works. And one of the things I had to do this year, you know, I have a, you know, preseason prior, which, you know, fuels the ratings for the first half to two thirds of the season, you know, normal season. And the preseason rating would basically degrade by day during the season, which was fine mm-hmm. in a normal season. But this year, you know, you have certain teams that have played 25 games to this point and other teams that have played, you know, 12.
Right.
And so I've had to go to a system where the preseason prior is basically on a per team basis, how many games have they played? And, and I think that's improved things. I think that'll improve things going forward when we have a normal season again. Like, it'll, you know, make the model marginally better, just, you know, a more, you know, a better use of the preseason prior, really, to inform the team's rating based on the games they played.
Right. Right. So speaking of priors, so this is, we talk about it a lot on the show, and we're kind of evangelists for people using priors in all walks of life. Is there any team this year that you think priors are especially important on, that maybe people got distracted early on by something that happened, and if they walked away too quickly from the prior, they have them wrong now?
Yeah. So I think this question is probably more important in like a month ago or 2 months ago. Like, by now, you know, most rating systems, the prior is gone for most teams, or it's very small, and so it doesn't make a huge difference. But certainly teams like Duke and Kentucky, who came into the season highly ranked by any preseason rating that someone in my line of business has or human polls. They were expected to be top 25 teams, and they didn't come close to playing like that early in the season.
Right.
You know, they've since, I won't say completely turned things around. Both teams are having their worst seasons in recent memory, but they're not as bad as their record indicates. They're not as bad as they looked in the first 6 weeks or so of the season. And, you know, without that preseason prior, you would have been really underrating their future performance, you know, back in January, mid-January or so. So that's where it comes in handy.
Talk a little bit more about these top teams this year. For months now, people have been talking about basically a big two, at least from a distance. It seemed to me like a big two. For a while, it was Gonzaga, Baylor. The Bears lost a conference game just recently against Kansas. Kansas is usually the team people are talking about out of the Big 12. Kansas has not been the top team in the Big 12, but they nicked the Bears, dropped them down to number three. But can you talk to us a little bit about Gonzaga and Baylor? It's a pretty unusual basketball season when there are two teams. It's not unusual to have two teams really at the top, but two teams. Gonzaga's been in the national lights for a while. Baylor, not so much, but together. And then Carolina's not around. Duke's not around. Kentucky's not around so much. What's your explanation for how that happens all of a sudden?
Well, in the case of both Gonzaga and Baylor, like in a normal season, they would have been great too. Like there's nothing necessarily that this season is helping them with, but they both are experienced. They both generally, you know, have some continuity in their program. Gonzaga is led by a freshman point guard. So, I mean, they do have a freshman playing a key role, but Baylor basically does not. You know, they're all upperclassmen. And so both those teams are expected to play well. They both have played well. You mentioned Baylor kind of stumbling. They had a recent 3-week pause and they have not looked the same in their two games coming back. Part of that is probably because this was a team built on, at least offensively, on unreal 3-point shooting. They still lead the country actually in 3-point shooting at 42%, but they were even higher before these last two games where certainly against Kansas, you know, they went 3 of 16 from 3-point range. And you might expect that 42% number to gradually drift down, you know, into the even lower 40s or maybe high 30s as we, you know, we get into the Big 12 tournament and NCAA tournament, just because of the natural, you know, regression to the mean phenomenon and playing better defenses too.
Right. Well, you know, it's interesting to me to see your rankings lined up against the AP, you know, top 25 or whatever. We mentioned the Baylor dropped a notch. Michigan slid in to number two, and that top three matches yours exactly, Gonzaga, Michigan, Baylor. Before we drop into lower numbers, I want to see some of these other teams because I want to know who to pay attention to. But in general, Ken, do you think it's fair to say that the polls have come to the analysts in the time that you've been doing this? Let's say you've been doing this for 15 years or so. It feels to me like this is one sport where you guys have really helped the media who cover you're the sport become more sophisticated.
I think in general, that last statement is true. I don't have much to compare that to. I guess the obvious comparison is to college football. You know, there's two college sports, right? The two most popular college sports are on TV all the time. The analytics movement in football is pretty sophisticated as well, but I don't see a lot of that knowledge permeating, you know, the broadcasting commentary when I'm watching college football games the way it does in college basketball. So I do think from the standpoint of understanding which teams are good, what team strengths are, you know, offensively or defensively, understanding how a team's possession count impacts, you know, can skew your view of a team's offense or defense. I think in that way, certainly we've made a difference. I'm not so sure in the AP poll that it's really made a huge difference. There are pollsters who are maybe slightly influenced by my work. There's one pollster in particular, Jesse Newell out of Kansas City, who basically uses analytics purely to create his ballot. But I still think most pollsters fall back on the old win-loss, you know, thing, and they're not going to drop a team if they won, and they're not going to let a team rise if they lose, even if they lose to a great team in a close game, right? So I don't think there has been much change in that area, honestly.
Okay. All right. So I'll temper my enthusiasm for the world there. Ken, let's talk about where you think that discrepancy might pay if you want to either pick a team in your bracket or just pick a team to pay some attention to. Who do you think are some teams that – might be underappreciated or underrated or for whatever reason at this point in the season that we might pay attention to in the tournament?
Well, I'll start with, I guess, the reigning national champion, Virginia, who is 15-6 out of the ACC. They're ranked 13th in my system. People are probably familiar with Virginia's typical style, which is to have a very slow-paced team and an outstanding defense. And this year, they're a very slow-paced team. They do not have an outstanding defense. Their defense is ranked 32nd. Offense is ranked 15th. They're just constructed a little bit differently. They took on a transfer from Marquette and Sam Hauser, who is an outstanding three-point shooter, maybe not a great defender, but more of an offensive-minded player. And anyway, they're just not built great defensively, and they've also lost their last three, so people are off the bandwagon. The ACC is not strong this year, so they don't really have like a signature win that people are going to look at and be like, oh, wow, yeah, that team can obviously play with the top 20 teams in the country. But, you know, when you just look at the overall track record, they've beaten a lot of teams in the 30 to 40 range. They're still at the top, near the top of the ACC. Jury's still out a little bit. Obviously want to see what they do towards the end of the season. But I guess I wouldn't sell my stock on Virginia right now. I still think they're a team that can win a few games in the NCAA tournament.
Okay. That is, I'm glad you talked about the ACC because it is a little bit of an unusual year that we don't hear as much from that conference. We hear a lot from the Big Ten. We hear a lot from the Big 12. But it also feels like some other kind of in football we'd call their group of five, but they're not the Power Five conference kind of teams. Can you give us some folks to pay attention to that might be traditionally off the radar a little bit? They're not last year's defending champion.
Right. Yeah, certainly Houston out of the American conference. The American kind of fancies itself as a power conference, but for basketball purposes, they're a shade below the top six leagues. But Houston's ranked fourth in my system. They've been, basically toiling in obscurity, playing in the AAC. There aren't really any other high profile teams in that league this year, but earlier in the season, they beat Texas Tech, out of the Big 12. They're undefeated in non-conference play and they're 13-3 in the AAC. So ranked fourth in my system. When they're winning, they're, just completely blowing out some pretty good teams. They actually scheduled a non-conference game against Western Kentucky last week just to kind of stay sharp. And Western Kentucky's a decent team, ranked 84th in my system. And Houston basically, it was a close game in the first half, but just completely ran away from them in the second half and won by 24. So,
all right.
Well, so Houston's the team to watch.
That's a fun one. I mean, that's Phi Slamma Jamma, man. There's a national championship in that building. So they've got a pedigree. Good. And you've got quite a bit of discrepancy on them versus the AP. You got them way up there at number four, and I had the AP here a minute ago, but they're certainly not that. Give us one more. You're going to give us three teams to keep an eye out for: Virginia, Houston, and who else would you point us toward?
Well, I'll point you towards a more of a controversial team that I'm not sure I'm sold on, but my ratings are really sold on, and that's Loyola Chicago, who people are familiar with their Final Four run, I believe it was 3 years ago, out of the Missouri Valley. They're ranked 11th in my system, number one defense in the country, and they finished 16-2 in league play. And again, a team that just really crushed some, good but not great competition in their league. Didn't play, necessarily, again, all these teams didn't play a great non-conference schedule because there just weren't that many non-conference games to play. But they lost to Wisconsin, lost to Richmond in non-conference play, so people might be not sold on Loyola Chicago. I have to admit, I'm not actually super sold on them and watching them play. That's one of those things where I'm, every time I watch them play, they look like a team that's not a top 25 team, but history would tell you the way they're dominating the Missouri Valley that, they are at least a top 25 team and they could be dangerous to whoever they play, in the first or second round of the tournament.
Okay. Talk to us briefly about as a modeler, how do you manage that tension between what your model says? I mean, let's stay with this example, between what your model says about Loyola Chicago versus how you feel and from watching and thinking about them.
It's tough. Sometimes I want to take a sledgehammer to my computer when I see Loyola Chicago struggling with teams that are much worse than them. But there is some reassurance knowing that the games I'm not watching, they're actually performing much better than the games I'm watching. So, so that's a thing to keep in mind. It's one of those things where it's just something you, I think, don't get too stressed out over in the moment, but certainly something I want to remember for the off season when I'm thinking about, kind of tweaks to make to the model is, is there something I can do that will solve this problem. And again, a lot is going to depend on how they play the rest of the year. I mean, if Loyola Chicago goes back to the Final Four, I'm going to, you know, of course, shed this feeling very quickly. But if they get upset in the first round or something like that, then it's a different story, obviously.
Right, right, right. Hey, you talk about tweaking in the offseason. You've been doing this long enough. I'd be curious to know what you feel like. What margin have you worked on the most over the years, or what tension are you navigating in your model, or what do you feel like is, if you could push advance one edge, what would it be? How was this thing changing?
Yeah. You know, the college, you know, the challenge of college basketball is that you have, you know, teams of such vastly different skill levels and conferences of such vastly different skill levels. So, you know, obviously with a team like Michigan or Baylor, they're playing the best teams in the country night in, night out in their leagues. And Gonzaga, you know, they played some great teams in the beginning of the season, but they're not playing great teams right now. And so evaluating them against their schedule and comparing that to, you know, Michigan against their schedule is an enormous challenge. And trying to solve that challenge has been it's very difficult over the years. And I don't know that I necessarily even have a great way of doing that now, but that's something that if I could ever figure out that issue, I feel like I've solved rating basketball teams.
Well, Ken, I'll spare our listeners more details on that, even though I would love to have that conversation with you. We obviously grapple with a lesser version of the problem with the Massey Peabody football ratings. But it's a perennial problem in if the system's not closed and everything's not balanced, it's a perennial problem in any analytics. Is how do you level things up? How do you adjust for context appropriately? And you do have a big one. I mean, how many basketball teams are eligible for the tournament? I mean, this, we're talking high 200s, low 300s. It's ridiculous the number you have to stay on top of.
Yeah, like in a normal year, there'd be 357 Division I teams. Jeez, a few of them are not eligible, but you're over 340 certainly. So it's a huge challenge. And this year, more of a challenge because there's fewer non-conference games. So the difference between conferences is really less well calibrated than it is in a normal season. So that is another layer of difficulty that I'm dealing with.
Mm-hmm. Well, that it presumably just adds more intrigue to the tournament here in a couple of weeks. So the tournament's going to tip off. The show's going to go up on Wednesday. And at that point, we'll be, I think, two weeks and a day from the first four. Which is going to be in Indiana this year. Everybody's circling up in Indianapolis and playing in a few towns around Indianapolis. It's going to be super interesting, but this is just one more way in which it's interesting. You know, unbalanced schedules, different numbers of games, less connected conferences. Hey, one of the things that I heard you dealt with is this, the seeding out in the West Coast Conference. So the fact that some teams have played 25 and some teams have played 12, to take an extreme example, gives a conference a real challenge when it comes to seeding their conference tournament. So is it true that you've worked with the West Coast Conference in seeding the tournament and navigating this problem? And if so, what did you suggest?
Yes. So yeah, this was an issue that I think people hoped wouldn't be an issue before the season. And there wasn't really a lot of planning going on in terms of, hey, how should we seed our conference tournaments? You know, if one team has played 8 games and one team has played 15, are we just going to use winning percentage? Are we going to do something else? And nobody really came up with a great solution for that. But about 3 weeks ago, the WCC realized this was an issue. Actually, their member schools realized it was an issue. And for people who are not familiar, the WCC is really this oddball conference where the best team in the conference is Gonzaga, who's the best team in the country, according to my ratings. And the worst team is Portland, who is the 330th best team in the country. So a huge range of teams in this conference. And obviously as games are getting canceled, you know, if you had a game canceled with Portland, like if you're going to go by winning percentage to seed the conference tournament, like you had a huge incentive to make up that game. Whereas if you got a Gonzaga game canceled, you would probably be like, do we really need to make that one up?
Right.
So there's some grumbling in the conference that teams were maybe like doing this. And so they kind of came to me and said, hey, can you come up with a way to seed the conference tournament? We don't want to obviously use margin of victory. We don't want to use anything about team reputation or any priors. We just want to use win loss in conference play. And so I came up with a little formula basically based on Bradley Terry, kind of classic Bradley Terry algorithm, with some adjustments for home court advantage and other things. But for the most part, pretty simple algorithm and fair algorithm. And ultimately, somehow the conference got the teams to buy into it, and that's what they went with.
Well, Well, anytime you're selling an entire conference on an algorithm, we're impressed. But tell us just a little bit more about the Bradley Terry algorithm. What are the key features there? How is it able to navigate this problem?
Yeah, basically just rewards you. So I get the one nice feature about it, like people in college basketball are probably familiar with the RPI and how there was a quirk in the RPI where you could play games against teams, and even if you won those games, your rating could drop, or you could lose games and your rating would go up. But the Bradley Terry algorithm basically just rewards you for wins and penalizes you for losses. And that reward for winning is proportional to the difficulty of the team you play. So you could play Portland and you would actually get rewarded, a very, very small reward, but you would get rewarded. Whereas if you played Gonzaga and you beat them, you would get rewarded a lot. Nobody, of course, was successful in doing that. But if somebody had done that, they would have been rewarded a lot. So it basically just looks, wins and losses, who you've played, who you beat. And I kind of convert it to what I call an adjusted winning percentage. So basically, if you played an entire league schedule, what would your winning percentage be on this based on this rating? And for both the men's and women's side, it was pretty close to an order by natural winning percentage anyway. But there were some exceptions on the men's side where one team in particular, St. Mary's, played a very difficult conference schedule, limited but difficult. And another team, Loyola Marymount, played a very easy conference schedule. And so St. Mary's actually jumped them in the seeding for the conference tournament because of that.
Okay. It sounds ELO-ish. It's close to ELO then, I'm guessing.
Yeah. So there's two options, I think, for a rating system like this, either ELO or Bradley Terry. The difference is, like, I feel like ELO is sort of like memoryless in a way. Like if you beat the number one team, you get credit for that. And if the number one team becomes the number 12 team in 2 weeks, like you still get credit for beating the number one team.
I see. Okay.
Whereas in Bradley Terry, you're getting credit for beating the number 12 team at that point. Like it adjusts based on
it. It adjusts down. Oh, nice. Nice. Now you're assuming, that there are trade-offs there, right? Because maybe they were the number one, maybe they had some injuries or whatever. So I get that there's a trade-off, but I can imagine why you might want to take it in the direction that you took it. The other interesting wrinkle that you said there is that in the way you translated the results, you translated it into a kind of an expected win percentage if you had played the normal schedule. That seems to me like a terrific example of putting it in the language that they're accustomed to consuming it, right? It's like, forget what the algorithm says. I'm going to put it in the language that you want to use, and that probably makes it more palatable.
I think so. This all came together very quickly, by the way. Like it really was like a day or two, they needed something quickly. And so this is what I came up with. And the first iteration of it was just the kind of the raw rating out of a Bradley Terry system.
Right,
it was just a number, which doesn't make any sense.
1,700. Loyola.
Yeah, right.
Right. 1,700.
Like Gonzaga was like 12 and Portland was like 0.2 or something. And it doesn't make any sense to anyone. And so
right.
I did. The light bulb went on a couple of days later that, yeah, we should convert this to a winning percentage and people would kind of get what the goal of the system is here. And so I think that might have sold it a little bit more easily.
That's great. Ken, listen, we're at the end, but I want to, before we go, touch on this thing that the Washington Post wrote about just a couple of weeks ago. Apparently, you made good use of your COVID downtime. About this time last year, they were canceling conference tournaments. In fact, it was this coming week. It was this week that they were canceling tournaments. And so all of a sudden, no March Madness. You've got some free time, sadly, on your hands. And you decided to turn to curling. So it sounds like this is something you had taken up yourself, and then you just as a player, and then you said, let's do a little bit of analytics on this. So curling, as some people know, of course, is this kind of shuffleboard on ice that the Canadians are crazy about, and it's an Olympic sport. And so we're going to have a little bit of this ahead of us in the future. And can you just say a little bit about I wouldn't have known that analytics would be an important part of curling, or could be.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like any sport, there's data out there and there hasn't been a lot of work done in curling analytics, but it's something that, having played the sport and having kind of followed the world curling scene pretty closely, like there's just not a lot of analytics for a novice fan to start to understand like who the great teams are and who the not great teams are. And so that's what I started doing. As soon as college basketball shut down, I really wasn't interested in like all these things that people are doing, simming the NCAA tournament or anything like that. Like I didn't want to do that. I wanted to work on something real, And so, so worked on these curling ratings, which oddly is like the reason, we just talked about the WCC, but a lot of the work on the curling ratings, kind of kicking the tires on the ELO or Bradley Terry, that work translated very nicely into the WCC work as well. So there was some benefit to college basketball from my work on curling as well.
That's great. That's great. Well, good fun. And it's a fun Washington Post article. You guys can track it down. Ken Pomeroy and curling in the WAPO just a couple of weeks ago. Listen, Ken, as always, appreciate a chance to visit with you. Thanks for the tips on some teams. Just to remind you guys, it's not the three, but we kind of dug three out of Ken's numbers. Virginia, which is kind of a traditional power, and obviously the defending champs, maybe a little underappreciated. U of H, formerly Phi Slamma Jamma from back in the 80s, a kind of group of five team, if you would. And then Loyola Chicago, which sounds like a computer team. Ken's not sold on, but his model says is good. So Virginia, Houston, Loyola Chicago for you guys filling out your brackets in the next couple of weeks. And of course, you can get more from Ken on KenPom.com, KenPom.com. Ken, always a pleasure. Thanks for being here.
Appreciate it, Kate. Thanks a lot.
Absolutely. And that has been another Wharton Moneyball 2 hours of sports analytics. We do that, of course, every week here on SiriusXM. For the whole crew, Shane Jensen, Audie Weiner, Eric Brattle, this has been Cade Massey. Thanks to the boss man who makes it happen, Maddie D, Maddie Dats, for the associate boss man also making it happen, frankly, Dion Simpkins. And you guys for listening. Come back and join us next week. Between now and then,